Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The number one new release in forensic psychology, Small Town Charm with Deadly Consequences. A collection of nonfiction accounts by international writers and experts on small-town true crime shows readers that the real monsters aren't hiding in the woods, they're inside our towns. Small towns aren't always what they seem. We've been told nothing bad happens in small towns. You can leave your doors unlocked and your windows wide open. We picture peaceful hamlets with a strong sense of community, and everyone knows each other. But what if this wholesome, idyllic image doesn't always square with reality? Small towns might look and feel safe, but statistics show this isn't really true. Tiny town, big crime. Whether in Truman Capote's detailed murder of the Clutter family or Ted Bundy's small town charm, criminals have always roamed rural America and towns worldwide. Featuring murder stories, criminal case studies, and more, the best new true crime stories, Small Towns, contains all new accounts from writers of true crime, crime journalism, and crime fiction. And these entries are not based on a true story. They are true stories. Edited by acclaimed author and anthologist Mitzi Cerrito, the stories in this volume span the globe. Discover how unsolved murders, kidnapping, shooting sprees, violent robbery, and other bad things can and do happen in small towns all over the world. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Best New True Crime Stories, Small Towns, New and Original Stories Never Before Told, Criminology, Forensic Psychology, Fans of Unspeakable Acts, with my special guest journalist and author and editor, Mitzi Cerrito. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Mitzi Cerrito.
Thanks, Dan, for having me back. It's great to be here again.
Thank you so much. Let's talk about the origins of this Best New True Crime Stories, and by going through just the contents of this and some of the authors, and maybe give along the way some of the reasons why you chose these authors and the location of these very, very international stories. In this book, you start off with a story called Snowtown by Anthony Ferguson. The next one is A Tragedy in Pisoria, When People's Justice Goes Horribly Wrong by Tom Larson. Then we have About a Boy from C.L. Raven. Then 20 Cents Worth of Arsenic by author Edward Butts. And then we have a story from you, Mitzi, I Kill for God. And we'll come back to that. The next entry is The Summer of the Fox by Mark Fryers. And then Who Killed Gabriel Schmidt, The True Story and the Mystery Surrounding a Forgotten Murder by Alexandra Burt. Then you have Bullets and Balaclavas, The Long, Cold Orkney Shooting by Charlotte Platt. And you have The Black Hand and Glass Eye of Erlemart, A Killer's Perspective from Christian Cipollini. You next have Crime Has Come to Pinal, Iris Leona Marie Cross. Next you have The Voodoo Preacher by David Brassfield. And then you have La Bella Elvira, Murder in the Tuscan Hills with Deidre Pirro. After that, you have The Doctor, The Dentist, and The Dairyman's Daughter with author Paul Williams, and In the Home of the Cannibal by author Joe Turner, Nameless in Van Diemen's Land by Stephen Wade, and that's it.
That's quite a bit.
Let's go back to Let's go back to Snowtown and tell us, our audience, just a little bit, briefly, about what Snowtown is about. By Anthony
Well,
Ferguson.
Snowtown, yeah, Snowtown is a pretty notorious case. Snowtown all took place around the late 1990s, 1999 to be precise, in South Australia, in the Adelaide vicinity. Snowtown is actually a very small town, and the irony is that the murders in this particular case weren't really all committed in Snowtown. I think there was only one murder that actually took place there. But
right.
This case has actually been called the Bodies in the Barrel case. And it's a series of murder victims who were essentially stored in plastic barrels. There were actually four protagonists, three main ones, plus a fourth who was an accomplice. And it was an insurance scheme, not an insurance scheme, but an ID theft, getting hold of people's unemployment and their bank accounts. So there were these real, really losers, to be blunt, who targeted individuals. Sometimes they were just vulnerable individuals, random individuals. Often it was people they just didn't like. They seemed to have an issue with homosexuals, and they basically lumped them in with pedophiles. So that was their excuse to kill people. So if somebody, you know, if somebody happened in their circle who was homosexual, that was that they found a reason to kill them. The irony was that some of the protagonists were actually practicing homosexuals, so there's
right.
not a lot of logic there. But so they basically were just killing people. They would relocate to another area. They would kill more people. They would store these bodies in these barrels, and these barrels ultimately ended up in a disused bank vault in the small town of Snowtown. And that is why the case has been associated with this town.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And these
you
were
also
pretty brutal murders. They, you know, these were torture murders. These weren't just straight off, you know, bumping someone off. They were enjoying what they were doing to these poor people.
Right. This incredible case, you also write near the end of the story, or actually Anthony Ferguson does, he writes of a phenomenon called dark tourism that many people might not know of. Maybe you can tell us about dark tourism.
Yeah, well, I mean, the actual, you know, obviously it's a true crime story, and there has to be a lot of information and background information so the reader can understand what this case is about. But that is not the whole focus of the story, as you say. Anthony had actually gone to visit Snowtown on a road trip because obviously he was just fascinated about this case and how Snowtown got tainted. And yeah, they have been tainted. This town has been tainted by these killings. And Snowtown's just become almost a tourist attraction. And Anthony talks about this dark tourism and how people visit areas that have had horrible crimes, and it is a tourist attraction. Snowtown certainly doesn't want it to be a tourist attraction, but now, you know, things are so bad there, and it's just such a depressed place that they're starting to wonder if they should cash in on this dark past that they have. And Anthony mentions other places as well that have become popular tourist attractions, such as with the Jack the Ripper killings in Whitechapel, and people would go to the old East End of Whitechapel and take Ripper tours. But, you know, he poses the moral question that, you know, the Ripper murders were a long time ago, and in Snowtown was only in the late 1990s, and there are still people who are affected by these crimes. There are still family members, friends, loved ones of victims, and they're still alive. And is it really morally ethical to perhaps turn Snowtown into a tourist attraction when this is really a much more fresh crime than, say, something that happened in the Victorian days?
Yeah, certainly more understandable. The victims reliving this with the with tourists running around and and gawking and looking for information. Yeah, so I think there should be at least some conversation about having maybe 100 years pass before you could do something like that.
Yeah.
At least. Now, we talk about a tragedy, and I guess I've maybe mispronounced this, Pisorja, but this is an incredible story, October 16, 2018, and 2,000 citizens breaking into a police station. Tell us a little bit about this story by Tom Larson.
Yeah, that's quite a story. I think it's Pisorja, if I'm getting my Spanish correct. Tom Larson is actually a writer who has spent a lot of time in Ecuador. He lived there for many years and wrote for the English language newspapers there. So yeah, he was pretty au fait with the culture and the country. Now, in this particular story, it focuses on the concept of indigenous justice or people's justice. And this is actually something that's been incorporated into the Ecuadorian constitution. And a lot of this is as a result of the people's distrust of police and authorities in general, and of course, widespread corruption. So the people don't have a lot of faith in the authorities to perhaps bring criminals to justice. And as we know, indigenous justice, you take justice in your own hands. Now, in this particular case, it backfired. What happened was two women were robbed. There were three perpetrators, and these two women apparently had this powder blown into their face. There's a drug that is quite popular in South America to use for immobilizing victims. And in this case, this is what happened to these two women, and they were robbed of some money and their cell phones. And apparently they were, I believe, on their way to get their children from school or had just dropped them off, one or the other. So what happened was somehow on social media, it started to take off that the three perpetrators were pedophiles and that they had drugged and molested a local child. Now, there was no actual child involved, but somehow this just got blown out of proportion through social media, and people were getting really, really riled up about this. And the three victims who were, the three perpetrators who, yes, they were the victims afterwards, that were arrested for this robbery were in a prison cell. And as I said, you know, the flames were being fanned by social media, and the people just literally crashed right into this police station and dragged these three people out and lynched them in the street. And it was an absolutely terrifying situation, including for the police, because they were basically impotent in there. You know, you have a mob of people coming in and doing this. So ultimately, the three people who were murdered, the three accused, they did not molest any child. They had nothing to do with it. It was basically a straightforward robbery of, I believe, $200 and the phone.
Right. Wow. And what does this touch off in the country itself?
Well, you know, there's obviously, you know, a lot of backlash against social media. But on the other hand, the police have said that social media has been very helpful in locating people who go missing. And a lot of people have come forward seeing things posted. So it's sort of a double-edged sword and something quite relevant now, because we see social media used for good and for bad. But, you know, people still in this area, they still do not really trust the authorities, and they feel that it's, you know, they feel pretty helpless that if they don't do something, no one else will. And they just get a lot of promises, this will be done, that will be done, and it doesn't get done. And unfortunately, we hear this quite a bit from a lot of Latin American countries, South American countries. So nothing's really changed. And this is only 2018, so we're pretty fresh here with when this happened.
Yeah, a lynch mob of 2,000 breaking into a police station in 2018 and enacting street justice is incredible.
Yeah,
incredible story.
Yeah, I mean, I just, the people that have been affected by this, to actually see this televised, you know, the videos of their parent or their, you know, family member being lynched in the street. And there's interviews in the story about how someone actually did see, I believe it was their mother or father, I'm not sure which one, being killed in front of their eyes on video.
Yeah, incredible. Now, there's another story about a boy by C.L. Raven, and this is in a Welsh mining town. You write 14 miles north of Cardiff.
Cardiff,
Harold Jones, the murderer. Tell us a little bit about this story by C.L. Raven.
Well, this took place in 1921 in a poor Welsh mining town called Abertillery. I believe I've said that correctly. Harold Jones was 15, and he worked at this sort of a feed store, you know, a farming store, a family-owned business. And as I said, it's a small town. Everybody's pretty close-knit over there. And he ultimately brutally killed two little girls, an 8-year-old girl and an 11-year-old girl. Now, what happened in this instance, when the first girl was found murdered, the 8-year-old, Harold was brought in for questioning, and basically nobody believed he would have been capable of this. You know, it was, you know, their boy from the local village or the local town. The townspeople rallied around him. They refused to believe that, you know, Harold would have done anything like this. And he was actually acquitted of the first murder. And what was particularly painful is for obviously the victim's family is that he was actually celebrated like he was a hero. You know, I mean, I don't know if anybody could even imagine what that would feel like if your child was murdered and the guy that the boy who was supposedly the killer is acquitted and you're pretty sure he did do it. And everyone's saying, what a hero. He's wonderful. And they're parading through the street and pennants are flying. So essentially, being this kind of a killer, he felt compelled to repeat the process, and he killed an 11-year-old girl. And these were not just simple killings. They were pretty brutal, you know, smashing in heads and pretty bloodthirsty killings. So finally, he ends up going on trial for that killing and was found guilty. But there's some interesting aspects to this story because of his age. He was just under the wire not to be hanged, because at the time, I believe it was age 16, you would be hanged for that kind of a crime. And so Harold, to save himself, pleaded guilty rather than go to trial, because had this gone to trial, it would have dragged on past his 16th birthday. And if found guilty, he would have hung for his crime.
Right.
But he actually did get released later on against the advice of professionals who felt that he was not safe to be released. But he was released in his adult years, and he relocated to London. And there's an interesting connection here. The authors have managed to trace this to another potential serial killing case, the Hammersmith nude murders, which were, they were adult women, but it was serial killing again. And Harold actually lived very near there. And they paint a very convincing story that Harold Jones may well have been responsible for those murders, although that was never actually proved. I believe that no one ever was found guilty of those murders.
You have a story called 20 Cents Worth of Arsenic by Edward Butts. What was so unusual about this case of poisoning?
That's an interesting one, and it's sort of from your neck of the woods, Woodstock, Ontario, Canada.
Right.
And that was around 1935. This is a life insurance scam story. Elizabeth Tilford, who was a who had moved to Canada from Britain, she had actually this she married a gentleman, Tyrell. This was actually her third husband. Her first two husbands died, so Elizabeth didn't have a great track record, and that probably had some bearing later on what happened. But her husband was accusing her of trying to poison him. And he was telling his family that, you know, Elizabeth's trying to kill me. She's trying to poison me with arsenic. And he was obviously becoming ill from whatever was happening to him. And she denied it. She denied it completely. But the interesting thing is that the arsenic that he said he was being killed with, there was arsenic. It was purchased to supposedly kill rats, but there were actually no rats. Even Elizabeth said there were no rats. And then they found out that the arsenic was not even ordered by Elizabeth. It was ordered by her daughter, who claimed that Tyrell, who was her stepfather, told her to order this arsenic. So that's all very fishy right there for a supposed wife who's trying to poison her husband, that he's actually involved with ordering the poison himself. So it's an interesting case because it leaves a question open that was Elizabeth trying to kill her husband to collect on some life insurance, because her defense claimed that he was framing his wife, in essence, planning his own murder in which to frame his wife for. And I think after reading Edward Butt's story, there was a really compelling argument that Elizabeth may not have tried to kill him. However, the court did not see it that way. And unfortunately for Elizabeth, she was hanged for the murder of her husband.
Yes. Let's talk about The Summer of the Fox by Mark Friars.
Yes, you remember Mark was on England. The show with me last time when we did the serial killers book. So
Absolutely.
Yeah. This story, Mark wrote about this. He was inspired to write this story because he was a young boy during this time. This was in the summer of 1984, and so he remembers it and, you know, how it's the fear that everyone had and whatnot. This is one of the few stories in the book that is actually not a murder story. Unfortunately, you just can't get away from murder when it comes to true crime. But this is actually about a serial rapist and serial burglar. This took place in the south of England. It primarily affected the town, countryside towns in Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire. There was a foray as well into South Yorkshire, which is in the north, but it was mostly in the south. This case involved a man who would be masked and generally gloved, and he would break into people's homes, and he would rob, and if there was a woman there, he would usually rape. There was no rhyme, no specific type he was after. It was women of all ages. If there were men present, he didn't care if there were men present as well. He sometimes tried to make them participate. In one horrible instance, he tried to make the woman's boyfriend and her own brother participate, which they were unable to do. Yeah, I mean, he really was wacko. So what happened was things got worse when he actually came across a gun in one of the homes that he broke into. And Mark mentions, and this is a really pertinent point, how somebody, once they get that gun, becomes so much more emboldened. It's as if it just props them up, and they can really feel as if they can play God. They can do anything now with this gun. And there's other instances of this in this book as well that creates a really strong argument about that. So anyways, the perpetrator, Malcolm Fairley is his name. This entire summer, people were living in terror with him. He just didn't know where he would strike next. It was to the point where people were rigging up all kinds of crazy things to try to set off an alarm if he would get in. The police were just going crazy trying to find this guy. It got to the point where the everyday burglar was like keeping a low profile because they didn't want to be associated with a crime that was this bad, you know? I mean, the fact right. that it was involved violence and rape and all of that, you know, the normal crook didn't want to even possibly go down that road to be tainted or accused of or being thought to be that person. So there's a lot of interesting information in the story about how the police investigated this and were trying to catch this guy. It was actually quite funny how he was ultimately caught. It was really because of a paint on a car, if you can believe that. That brought down Malcolm Fairley, the paint on a car. When he'd gone up to South Yorkshire, he had parked off the motorway and his car got scraped. So he had this distinctive scrape now on the front of it, on the front of his car. So he got caught by just regular old-fashioned police work where people were just looking for this particular color car. It was a specific paint. It was a specific yellow paint, and they were just looking for vehicles that were this color paint. And a cop randomly found this guy in London driving this colored car, and it had that scrape. And that is how they caught Malcolm Fairley. You know, what are the odds of that? And it was an interesting case as well because Fairley had a porn obsession. It was ultimately found yeah. that he had an obsession with especially violent porn and horror porn, and he would even try to act out scenes from these videos at his crimes. So this was someone who clearly had some influences that affected a lot of what he was doing when he was breaking into these people's houses.
Yeah, it's incredible behavior, unique and quite strange, to say the least.
Yeah, well, it's not unusual. I mean, there's other, I'm sure we've had many cases of people that have been influenced by these things.
I'm sure. It's not too many cases, though, where a guy stops and takes the time to watch pornos as inspiration.
Yeah, I mean, he actually did it in one of the victims' homes, and he made them watch with him. I mean, that is completely bizarre. And there was one thing, to interject a little humor in a pretty grim story, where he stopped and made himself a cup of tea.
Sure, why not?
I mean, you know.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second, Mitzi, to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. We all want to do the right thing to keep our bodies healthy in the long run. But even if we try really hard to eat kale salads and drink green smoothies, we're still most likely not getting all of the essential nutrients we need on a daily basis. Enter Ritual, the obsessively researched vitamin for women. Ritual's essentials have the nutrients most of us don't get enough of from food, all in their clean, absorbable forms. No shady additives or ingredients that can do more harm to your body than good. 2 easy-to-take capsules provide 9 nutrients you need to support a strong foundation for your health. My wife Lisa has been taking Ritual's essentials for over 4 months now. Essentials have been a big part of Lisa getting back to working out, and she says she's felt a significant difference since taking Ritual right from the very beginning. She was initially really impressed with the research that they put into Ritual's essentials, And again, she feels the difference every day as part of her routine with ritual. Better health doesn't happen overnight, and right now Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during their first 3 months. Fill in the gaps in your diet with Essential for Women, a small step that helps support a healthy foundation for your body. From D3 to omega-3, Ritual's Essentials for Women help fill gaps in a women's diet. There are no nausea capsules, designed as gentle on an empty stomach, and there's a mint tab in every bottle to keep things fresh so you don't get that fishy aftertaste common with most omega-3s. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/murder. Now, Mitzi, let's talk about a case that you wrote about and what you call I Kill for God. And this is a rural hamlet, Alger, Washington, 75 miles north of Seattle, about 45 minutes to the Canadian border, in a very tiny town, you say, of a 400 population. No post office and no schools. That's how small. And this is September 2nd, 2008, and a person named Isaac Lee Zamora, who's 28 years old. Tell us a little bit about Isaac Lee Zamora and this incredible tale, I Kill for God.
Yeah, this is quite a story. It's a spree killing, to just categorize it a bit. I've been spending quite a bit of time in the Pacific Northwest, so I had decided to actually visit the town just to sort of get a sense of it and everything, and then it just snowballed from there that I decided to write up about this particular case. Zamora was a man who, or still is a man since he's still with us, who had apparently a background of mental health issues going back many, many years, and his family had tried to get him help, and, you know, they didn't have resources, and so, you know, when you have to rely on trying to get help from the state and government agencies, it's not always very successful. But, you know, he was just kind of going along and basically, you know, doing whatever he could. He did have some run-ins with the law. He had some drug issues. He did have some jail time. But he, on this particular date, Isaac just essentially flipped. And he just went on a rampage, and he just started to kill people. These people were his neighbors. Some of them he didn't know at all. He broke into the house of somebody that he knew for many, many years, a neighbor of his, and he killed him. He killed a sheriff's deputy who came to respond to the 911 call. Sadly, he actually knew this sheriff's deputy because she knew him from past call-outs and knew that he had mental health issues that he was struggling with, and she had a family member who also had that, so she was empathetic and had actually even told the family, call me if, you know, anytime Isaac needs help, and he killed her, which is pretty horrible. He killed another neighbor. He killed some guys working on a construction project. He drove off on the freeway, and he killed some guy who was just driving down the freeway on his way to visit somebody. No rhyme or reason to the people he killed. He injured people as well. He shot some guy on a motorcycle at a gas station. He shot another neighbor who had just pulled into his driveway. One of the victims he murdered as well was also killed in her own driveway as she pulled in coming home from work. It's a pretty awful case. I mean, it's tragic in so many ways, because you wonder, well, if he had really got the proper help that he should have had, would this have happened? And then there's also there's an aspect of the story that it's almost a comedy of errors, because between the Department of Health and the DSHS and the the prison authorities. Nobody kind of wanted to take possession of him. You know, he was going to be like under the state, or he was going to be under the Department of Corrections custody. So this was back and forth too. You know, do we want him in the prison? Do we want him to be in the mental hospital? So this whole battle was going on as well. But what's interesting about this case is, and you know, a lot of things we don't hear so much about how this actually affects people in law enforcement, but I was lucky enough to have access to several of the law enforcement officials who worked on the case, lieutenants, detectives, et cetera. And there was so much to have to do with this case, because you had several different locations in which the crimes were committed. You know, you have, you know, this house, that house, the gas station, the freeway. So all these different locations, and being in a very rural area, this is not really conducive to, you know, say communication and all of these things. And it was, by the time this was all finished, when Isaac had finally finished, it was late afternoon. And so essentially, these police officers had to leave these bodies where they were overnight, because they could not perform their jobs. They could not properly gather evidence until daylight. And so there was a lot of really horrible feeling on their own part about how that they had to leave people there like that, especially one of their own, the sheriff's deputies. And so it was just such a complex case, because the county was not really properly equipped to deal with anything this big. They'd never had anything remotely like this. Alger is in Skagit County, Washington, and Skagit County is mostly rural, and this was just beyond their scope to deal with this. So, you know, people were being brought in from other agencies, because it just had to be dealt with like that. But yeah, I mean, it's an incredible story, really. And just to see the amount of ball dropping that was done. For instance, when Zamora had been in jail for his drug charge, they moved him from one county jail to one on the other side of the state. And apparently his records were not properly sent over. And so mental health issues were not being followed up with. Just things like that. When he was finally released, you know, you're supposed to have follow-up from the county. You know, people are supposed to, you know, check up on you. That wasn't done. And apparently somebody who was assigned to him had left on vacation and didn't even put anybody in charge. So it just seems like so many things went wrong in this case that I, you know, it was just a bomb waiting to explode, you know, and it did. Ultimately, Isaac did end up in Monroe, which is a mental health facility in south of Seattle, and he is still there as we speak. But again, he's, you know, it still doesn't end, because we're going back and forth with, you know, does the Department of Corrections have possession of him, you know, custody over him, or the Department of Health and Social Services? This is still going on. In the case of the trial itself, he basically plea bargained because he didn't want to get the death penalty. And at the time, that was on the table. And that's not what he wanted, obviously. So he pled guilty to a couple of the murders, and the rest of them not guilty by reason of insanity. And actually, oddly enough, as I was finishing the story and thought I thought it was finished, he was back in the news again, because he was contesting the murder conviction, that he wanted that overturned since the death penalty was overturned in Washington. So right. It's like it's never going to end. I mean, I finished the story, but I could probably keep writing the story.
Certainly. You write that a detective involved said certainly he had mental illness, but also that he also played the system as well. Like you say, this story is still, pardon me, this story is still not ended, because proceedings were still going on in 2019. What I thought...
Yeah.
horrifying was the classification or the misclassification of him at one time to be a nonviolent offender, and that was a big crux of this problem, wasn't it? Was the reclassification to be considered nonviolent when certainly there were flags present anyway, red flags.
Yeah, I mean, there was a history of him, you know, even his own family had called the police on him once because he was threatening. But exactly, you know, that's the thing, that the nonviolent offender thing. And they found out that there were, I believe, 1,000 some that were also misclassified. But, yeah, you know, that's the thing, though. You know, I mean, I didn't want to particularly slant the story in any particular way. That's not what my job is. That's not how I want to write true crime, have true crime in my book. And I presented different arguments. You know, we've got the mental health perspective. I've got experts on mental health talking about the situation in Washington State and in the United States in general and where it is. And yeah, okay, granted, Zamora definitely has mental health issues. But on the other hand, I've got several police officers who were involved in this case. And they had said very clearly, and they still say it because I still speak to them, that Isaac played the system, that he would be perfectly fine. Everything was great. Then they get into the courtroom and he suddenly starts acting really wacko. And then they get him back in the car to take him back to his cell and he's fine again. Another officer had said that, well, if he was that, you know, mentally ill and going on this, doing all these things, how did he finally, you know, manage to drive himself to the police station and turn himself in, that he could do something that rational after committing all these other irrational acts? So, you know, there's a lot to really think about in this story. And, you know, I suppose we'll never really know what was in his head. And I don't know, I suppose everyone will have a different opinion on it.
Well, that's what you write, that at court he said, I kill for God, I listen to God. But the thing is, what we didn't, we just glossed over in this, and the reader can read this in this story, where he mutilates the faces and the torso with a power saw of David Radcliffe and Greg Gilliam, and for no reason whatsoever. And like you mentioned, this Ann Jackson was so good that she recognized he had mental illness and reached out to him in case there was any problems, come to me, and he killed her. So ruthless murders of people that even neighbors that had known him for 20 years were killed. So I think that maybe you could have mental illness, certainly, and I think that's what the prosecutor was trying to say, that you could have this mental illness but still do what would seem like psychopathic murders as well. Tell our audience what would happen if, though, he were released from the mental hospital. What would be his fate afterwards?
Well, you know, the whole thing with having him, the way it was organized was they thought that he would never, ever, ever get out. And that was the whole thing about who's got custody of him. And he is still technically in Monroe, and he's in the special offender unit, which is for people with mental illness. So as of now, if he were, quote, released, I don't believe he'd actually be released out into the public. He would be released to be put in the regular prison population and in the prison itself and become under the custody of the Department of Corrections. So I don't really think it's likely he's actually ever going to be free and, you know, out there in the public. He would just be a matter of who's got custody of him and where his cell is located.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about another story before we don't have speak with you anymore. Who Killed Gabriel Schmidt? The True Story and the Mystery Surrounding a Forgotten Murder by Alexandra Burt. Can you give us a little background on this story?
Yeah, this is one of those stories that is a very personal story to the author. It's really in a memoir type of way of writing.
Right.
Alexandra Burt is originally from Germany, and so she was a teenager when this took place, which was in 1983, and it was still Cold War Germany, Cold War time, and East Germany and West Germany were still two different entities. So she talks about when she was growing up in Fulda, which is in central Germany, and it was on the border. I mean, she would go for walking and hiking, and she would literally see East Germany and see the watchtowers where they would be with their guns and guarding the border. So I believe she's 17 when this happened, and it all started with a little five-year-old girl going missing. So everyone's banding together trying to find this little girl, because this is just not something that happens.
Right.
And she's later found murdered. This child's later found murdered. And the story is a lot more about how this affected Alexandra as a person and how she imagines, what happened to this child, and how did this child, obviously she must have gone off with someone, because she wasn't found murdered in the same place she was disappeared from. So she obviously went away with someone. And so she's trying to envision how this happened. And she almost feels this sense that she must do that as a way of respect, to try to, respect this child who was murdered. And the sad thing about this is that it, as of today, it still remains unsolved. And Alexandra points out, why was this really not much talked about? Maybe there was a bit in the local newspaper, but it really didn't get much coverage, whereas other cases would get far more coverage. So it's a puzzle, and it's a puzzle that still haunts her today and has affected her own life and how she is with her own daughter. So it's really it's hard to talk about this story. I think it's definitely a story that has to be read, because I can't really put it into words anything better than what she herself has put into words. But it's a thought-provoking story, and it's very personal to the author.
Yeah, it's very interesting, too, that part of the relating for her was that she was a quarter mile away from where this abduction in broad daylight occurred. Very interesting.
I was just going to say, it makes me puzzled. I don't know, just to be suppositioning, but one of the first things that I thought of after reading the story was, because obviously the military, the West and the East merged, and the Cold War ended. But I kind of wonder if it might have been somebody who was over there helping West Germany, maybe a American serviceman or somebody who did this, and it was hushed up. That's the first thing that came to my mind, but that's not addressed in the story.
Yes. Let's talk about Bullets and Balaclavas, The Long, Cold Orkney Shooting by Charlotte Platt. And this is in Scotland, yep. Northeast coast of Scotland.
Yes, that's in Orkney, which is an island. Orkney's way, 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 way up at the top. After Orkney, you have Shetland, and then that's basically it. This takes place in Kirkwall, which technically Kirkwall is a city, and the only reason that it's a city is because it has a cathedral. But it's only got a few thousand people, so trust me, it's a town. This is a really interesting case. This was about this took place in 1994, and it was a gentleman by the name of Shamsuddin Mahmud, who was a Bangladeshi national. He was a waiter in an Indian restaurant in Kirkwall, and one day a male figure enters the restaurant with a gun and shoots him in the head and kills him. Out of nowhere, nobody quite understood why this happened or how it happened. There was lots of rumor was he involved in this? Was he involved in that? And there was nothing. There was no evidence to suggest this was any sort of, killing for a quote, reason. ultimately it was discovered that it was a racial killing. It was a racially motivated assassination against a man who the perpetrator didn't like his skin color. So this is an interesting case because what happened was, although they finally got who did it, initially they didn't. There was all kinds of things going on. There were, you know, crazy stories, people seeing, they saw someone walking around in the woods, whatever. They finally ended up picking up a 15-year-old male by the name of, I have to find his name, Michael Ross. Michael was the son of a police constable, and Michael was obsessed with firearms. He loved it. He loved guns. He loved weaponry, et cetera, et cetera. So although his father was eventually convicted of perverting the course of justice, nothing ever happened with Michael. So the case was unsolved. So Michael went off and lived his life. He joined the military. I think it was the Black Watch regiment, and he had a very distinguished career in that. And then when he came back, evidence was uncovered. Witnesses were suddenly coming forward. So all the way from 1994, we fast forward to 2008, when Michael Ross is finally called on the carpet as the perpetrator of this crime. He does get convicted of the murder. And what's particularly interesting in this is he was actually, the court was a court in Scotland that was used for terrorist cases. So we're talking about a very secure courtroom here. Michael fled. He tried to flee this courtroom and he was finally caught. But apparently he had a vehicle waiting for him with a cache of weapons and clothes and all kinds of supplies because it looked as if he was going to abscond to the Highlands to hide out. So, they did get him, and he is incarcerated, but he has had other attempts to flee, to try to escape from prison, and he still claims his innocence. And what's particularly interesting is that there are some on the island who still believe in his innocence, and there is a fund right now as we speak that should try to go toward his legal defense to get him acquitted. So it's a bizarre case.
Absolutely, as many of these are.
Yeah, I mean, no motive. It was just, obviously, it was just a racially motivated killing. That's it.
You have another story, The Black Hand and Glass Eye of Erlemart, A Killer's Perspective, from a friend of the program, Christian Cipollini, had been on the program a couple times on True Murder. This is an incredible story of intentional murder. Jose Martinez, you write in this story, start making headlines in 2013 with a confession of more than 30 murders in 12 states, including Mexico. He was known as the El Mano Negra, or the Black Hand. We don't have much time, but can you tell us a little bit about this incredible killer?
Yeah, this is a particularly interesting one because Christian actually had access to this guy, to Martinez. He did a lot of interviews with him in face-to-face interviews in prison, spoke to him on phone, communicating left and right. So he was he had full access and was getting this straight from Martinez's own mouth. So what's interesting is Christian discusses the story at the beginning about how this small-time drug dealer was found dead in Erlemart, which is a small town in Tulare County, California, which is largely a rural county. But he lets Martinez tell the story in his own words. So you really get a sense of this guy who's a cartel killer and his mentality and just him. There's just nothing quite like hearing his own voice, really, telling this killing. You know, it's bizarre.
Absolutely. You have another story again, very bizarre, The Voodoo Preacher, David Brassfield. This one's in June 97, Alabama. Vigilante,
yeah,
and a couple reverends. Tell us a little bit about this, just briefly.
Yeah, this was another one of these insurance scams. It's totally crazy. It was in Alabama, a small town in Alabama, and this reverend, I suppose you could call him a serial killer, but he kills his own family members just to get insurance money, wife, nephew, et cetera. And ultimately, he ends up being shot to death by the family member of a victim. It's quite an interesting story, and how the man who actually killed him did get off as temporary insanity. They just acquitted him because, But yeah, it's just bizarre, and there's even a tie in here with there's just so many elements to this particular story, and people who are still talking about it today, even though it was so many years ago.
Yes. You have another story, too, as well, in the home of the cannibal, Joe Turner. Can you just give us a brief description of what this story might be for readers to discover?
Yeah, this is a pretty bizarre one. Joe Turner actually traveled to Germany because he was fascinated by this case. Cannibal is the dead giveaway in this particular instance. But this is about a killer who, his name is Armin, I think Mewes. My German is not really good here. He wanted to find someone to ultimately kill and cannibalize, but it had to be consensual. This was his obsession, and so he was advertising. He was putting ads in online cannibal sites and whatnot, just trying to look for somebody. And he found someone. So Joe talks about in the story visiting this guy's house, which is abandoned. And he goes from room to room and discusses what aspects of the crime happened in each room. And it's a horrific story that it just seems, it's worse than you could even imagine with the Silence of the Lambs kind of thing. How this, that's the first thing that comes to mind. So he just advertised for a victim, and he finally found a victim, and he was able to fulfill his desires and the victim's desires. But what's interesting in this is how Joe does describe each room and describes the imagery of a refrigerator being near the door, the refrigerator that actually had body parts stored in the freezer. And Joe describes this refrigerator as if it wants to flee the horrors. It wants to go through that door and get away from the horrors that it has seen. I mean, it's just the imagery is amazing of how he just brings this story to life and a case that's pretty heinous, really.
Absolutely. There's another crime as well, our story called Crime Has Come to Pinal, a very interesting story as well from Iris Leone and Marie Cross. And it talks about all of the crime in Trinidad and Tobago. She goes away to live in England, and when she comes back, she hears rumors about how bad it is, how crime-ridden, and she has no idea. So an incredible story. We didn't touch on La Bella Elvira, Murder in the Tuscan Hills. Another fantastic story, and the doctor, the dentist, and the dairyman's daughter, and as well, Nameless in Van Diemen's Land by Stephen Wade. Truly an extraordinary collection of international authors and in this collection. I want to thank you very much, Mitzi, for coming on and talking about this. Tell us just a little bit about the book itself and where they might take a look at it, Facebook page, website. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, the official release date is January. Boy, I'm really losing the plot. July 14th. So it will be available pretty much everywhere. The usual booksellers, the trade paperback, ebook, and there's an audio edition as well, which I believe is going to be released on the same day. So readers, interested can find out more at my website, MitziSoretto.com. I'm really excited about it. I've had some great feedback so far, and I think that people will really find something worth reading in these stories. I just had a book review that came out yesterday, and it was called True Crime with a Conscience. So I kind of like that as a nice little tagline to use. So I think that kind of sums up what it is.
Absolutely. Again, I want to thank you very much, Mitzi Soretto, for coming on and talking about the best new crime stories, small towns. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much, and you have a great evening. Hope to talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Good night.